to say, like, you know, thank you, Mrs. Jones, for that beautiful music. Thank you, sweetheart. that was beautiful. I only call her Mrs. Jones, and I'm mad at her. And so I don't, you know, I'm kidding. Okay, that's a joke. But I very much appreciate that. I know everyone does. We get that special treat, that offering of a voice and heart and music and words. They have meaning. They touch our hearts, and they're offered up to God. I want to begin my message today by looking at another song. There was a song written, I'm going to guess, somewhere over 40 years ago, by a gentleman named John Lennon. Now, John Lennon, some of you may recognize that name. He was a member of the world-famous and in some ways world-changing Beatles. They came out of England. It was called the British Invasion. They changed music. And after a time, the Beatles broke up. John Lennon began and established his own musical career. And there's a song that he wrote that he's probably the most well-known for. And a few months ago, when the coronavirus pandemic began and everyone was asked to quarantine themselves and to stay home, and there began to be anxiety, fear, you know, of what this disease, this sickness, this virus could do, and, you know, could we die from it? And so in Hollywood, there were a group of celebrities who decided to get together, and not together, but online, and they would do a virtual choir, if you will, a singing of this song. And the song is entitled Imagine. It's really a simple song, yet it's lovely to hear. It's very melodic. And the people who got together and performed it, I think did it with the absolute best of intentions. But I want to start my message today by reading these lyrics, or reading some of them. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. You're saying there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's nothing to worry about or be afraid of. And whatever's up there, it's just the sky. There's no God. Imagine all the people living for today. That's more than just living in the moment. It's living in today because there's nothing else afterwards. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion to. See, those who believe that oppression, abuse, enslavement, corruption, they believe that that's where it all comes from. You know, that it's all these governments, it's all these countries, it's all these leaders and rulers, it's these churches, these religions, these gods that make everybody fight and kill one another. And wouldn't it be great if we could just not have any of that? He says, imagine all the people living life in peace. That if we could just get rid of all that, we'd finally have peace. He goes on and says, you know, imagine no possessions. Nobody owns anything. There's open borders It's all free. He says there's no need for greed or hunger. Because if there's no possessions, there's no borders, it's go where you want, everything's available, it's all free for you, it's right there. Then nobody will covet anything that anyone else has. And nobody will be hungry. He says, imagine a world living in peace. A brotherhood of man. That when we're all finally together as human beings, without all these other rules, without all these laws, without all these governments, without all these religions, it'll finally be wonderful. Imagine. The problem is, brethren, is that is a very utopian idea. And even those who, you know, teach the idea of lawlessness or having this all done away with, say it's pretty much impossible. It's not reality. What it is lawlessness. Now, some of you may have been hearing a word in the recent weeks. The word is anarchy. Anarchy, as we look around and see what's happening in our country, in fact, around in the whole world, that word has been put out there, whether it's in a newscast, whether it's on social media, on the internet, anarchy. People are marching and upset because they feel oppressed. They feel abused, neglected, that they have suffered. And so they want to throw all of this off of them. They just want to get rid of it all. And they believe that anarchy is the answer. So if we want to know what anarchy actually is, we can look at Merriam-Webster's dictionary. The first definition of anarchy is an absence of government. So no government, just like the song says. The second part is a state of lawlessness or political disorder due to the absence of governmental authority. So we're going to get rid of all of that. The third aspect of that definition is a utopian society of individuals who enjoy complete freedom without government. Because they see it as oppression. And if we could just throw off these chains of government, and everyone will be free, and everyone will be happy, and everyone will have just as much as everyone needs. Another aspect of this is the absence or denial of any authority or established order. You don't have to look very far for someone saying, I'll have no authority over me. No law, no rules, no governments, no structure. The complete absence of authority. I reject it. The Cambridge Dictionary describes anarchy as this: a situation in which there is no government and control, especially in society, because there is no effective government. Now, you can look at that in two ways. You can say that anarchy exists when there is no effective government. Or because there is an ineffective government, you have to have anarchy. It's funny how so many people are presenting this as the answer to all the problems that are happening, to all the strife, to all the conflict, to all the disagreement and discontent in our country. I was, again, going online, I was looking at different definitions and what people were promoting. And one of them that I came across, just a post online, was by a university professor of, I believe, philosophy. And he was a proponent of anarchy. And he basically said that anarchy is the state where there should be no government and no rules, because that would require someone to rule over you in order to enforce those rules. They also say that anarchy is all about peace, that it's the rules that make everyone violent. The enforcing of rules upon someone else who says, I don't want your rules. And so that it is the government, it is the rules, it is the laws that actually make violence. And if we could just do away with the laws and the rules, we would finally have peace. Now, some of those who are actually proponents of anarchy realize that it is a utopian idea. Noam Chomsky was a famous writer and philosopher who was a proponent of anarchy. And even he said, it's kind of a utopian or pie in the sky idea. And the reality is that it's just not possible. Anarchy, brethren, is lawlessness. It is not about peace. It is not about freedom. But this is also the way of the world. Human nature. Mankind doesn't like to be told what to do. We don't like authority. Authority's bad. It makes us angry. I want to do what I want to do. And the fact is, brethren, it has been the way of mankind since man was created. Lawlessness goes all the way back to Lucifer, the son of the morning star, who said, I'll have no one over me. I reject it. I'll be in charge. It's been infecting us ever since. So what does God say about anarchy? I want to turn to Matthew 24. Over the last months, I've looked at this quite a bit. I imagine some of you have too. I've used it in a few of my messages. Matthew 24, because the disciples were asking God, or Christ, what's going to be the sign of the end? Because, you know, you're the Messiah. We know that. So it's got to be about now, right? How will we know when it's going to happen? And so he tells them to be aware, to watch out for these things. Don't be deceived. People are going to be false Christs. They're going to be everywhere. There's going to be wars, rumors of wars, much like today. You know, look at the countries that are watching the United States for weakness right now, and they're loving it. And not only that, but we'll have nations rising against nation, kingdoms against kingdoms. Those are governments against governments, but those are also peoples, ethnic peoples, people who are different, people who are maybe of the same religion, Islam, but you have the Sunnis and the Shiites. You have everyone turning on everyone. You'll have famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. And Christ continues in verse 8 and says, and these are the beginnings of sorrows. He says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation. This is persecution. This is the pressure of it. And kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. Brethren, our whole world is offended. It's almost impossible not to offend someone. It's interesting because over the last months, especially, but it was happening before, but it has reached a fevered pitch, that someone will try to write something. Someone will put it out there that they intend to be helpful, that they want to be healing, that they want to unite us. And almost the second they put it out, there's a response that says, well, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. You're a bigot. And just because you said that means that you don't understand what I'm going through. And it can be about gender. It can be about your age. It can be about your color. It can be about your political thoughts. It doesn't matter. Everyone's offended. And it says they will betray one another and will hate one another. Even if that just means to love less, to stop loving someone. I've got individuals that I have known and loved who have placed, you know, warnings. Doesn't matter what our history was. Doesn't matter what our friendship was. If you agree with this, then you're gone. You're dead to me. I'm going to strike you from the records. It's not rational. It's human nature building and growing and festering, and it is taking control. It says, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. You know, so often we think that false prophets are false ministers, false preachers, dealing only with religion. But prophets are forthtellers and foretellers. They're supposed to be those who we turn to for truth, for enlightenment, for instruction. Like I said, the man that I was reading the other day is a university professor who is teaching our children, our youths, that anarchy is the way to go. Lawlessness. Just throw it all off and then you'll be free. In verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, because anarchy will exist, the love of many will grow cold. It's interesting because where all of these things are taking place, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's right here in our own little community, or whether it's, you know, a few hundred miles away in Minneapolis, it's burning. People are burning it down. Cars, houses, businesses. So that's fiery and burning and hot. But the love of many, that's grown cold. That warmth that we should have inside of ourselves, the love for our fellow man, that's burned out. That's cold now. And the fire is raging outside. But verse 13 says, he who endures till the end shall be saved. He who holds fast to what we've been given, to God's law, to His structure, to His order, will be saved. Brethren, that word lawlessness and the Strong's, the Greek word is anomia, or anomia. If you have a King James Bible, it actually says iniquity. The definition is illegality, meaning it's illegal. And that is a violation of law, or generally wickedness. Well, what does the Bible say the transgression of the law is? Sin. It's sin, and it covers all of it. It is the attitude of sin. Iniquity, transgression of the law. unrighteousness. It's interesting to me that one of the groups that has come into prominence in the last few years, and that is spreading across the country, is a group which is called Antifa. I kind of wondered what that stood for, but it means, it's an acronym for anti-fascism, anti-FA, fascism. And it's funny because if you go on and look at it, you go, well, what is this group? What do they stand for? What are they? And it literally says, we stand for nothing. We are a group which is dedicated to changing the country, the face of the world, not through government policy, but by action and violence. And they think they're going to get peace out of that. That's what they think they're doing. They're throwing off the shackles of oppression and destroying everything around them. It's interesting because I don't think any of them actually know what fascism is. They haven't experienced fascism. In our world, in our society, we've had it pretty good, haven't we? You know, World War II, the United States, the 50s, everything was booming. We had a whole new generation of babies born. There was growth, there was wealth, there was prosperity. We haven't had it bad. All the kids that are throwing rocks right now don't know what bad is. The last true fascists that came to any type of world prominence was Adolf Hitler and his ally, Mussolini. Fascism is not just patriotism. It's nationalism, which is all about crushing anyone who disagrees and empowering itself. And when I say crushing, it doesn't mean a law that you disagree with or a law which restricts you in your behavior. It's killing you. In the 1930s in Germany, while fascism was on the rise, the Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler, if you disagreed with him, you were more often than not found, drug out of your home, maybe your family with you, and you were sent to prison where you could be starved to death, you would die, they would kill you. Sometimes, as they got more and more strong and more powerful, they would just kill you in the street. That is fascism. What our youth today have experienced, they look at our government now and they're like, they're fascists. They don't know what fascism is. They've got it easy. It's not perfect. And life isn't fair. But they don't understand what they're doing. It's interesting to me that as I've seen these kids out there doing things, there was an article that my mother-in-law showed me. She had found where there was a woman who is a middle school teacher. And she was going through the news, and she was just shocked and flabbergasted, because she recognized her students as kids who were throwing the rocks. Middle school kids, 11, 12, 13 years old. They don't even understand what they're doing, but they're being allowed to have something inside them come out and run free and go wild, particularly young boys. You know, and there's an appeal to it. Rawr. You know, I mean, let's face it, men, and I know the women will be horrified by this, but think about when you were a kid, when you were a young boy, if you could break something and not get in trouble, Even just the sound of breaking bottles. Psh, rah. I know the women are like, but the guys, it was, There's something about that kind of power that is, it enhances, it's like a drug. Yeah, they crave it. It's this release, this no control. Rah. And it's appealing. And that's what they're doing, but they don't understand it at all. They don't understand that what they actually want and need is not lawlessness, because lawlessness is what makes them go crazy. They need structure. One of the things this woman was saying is like, where are their families? Where are their dads? But it's what human nature wants. Lawlessness. See, freedom in the eyes of man is no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. I don't want your right, your wrong, your ideas. I don't want your rules on me. I want to be free. Now, I want to ask you if that sounds just a little bit familiar. Put it to some music and have a young woman in a cartoon with a tiara on her head, and you've got a Disney smash hit, Frozen. And we're giving that to our children. And that we've been giving it to them ever since they were born. And you know what? They've heard it. They've listened to it. They've sung it. And it has sunk in. Those rules and those laws and you telling me that this is wrong, you're just inhibiting me. You're oppressing me. And I want to be free to do whatever it is I want. And the fact is adults like the same thing. Who do you think listens to John Lennon? We like that. Yeah, I did. We like that idea because of that human nature that is within us. But it's not godly. The reality, brethren, is that lawlessness, anarchy, always leads to violence. And violence leads to death. It's not peace. It's not freedom. James chapter 4. James, brother of Christ, who didn't follow him, didn't believe when Christ was preaching on this earth. Now, I wonder if he resented Christ. Oh, great, my perfect brother. He never gets in trouble. He's always the example. Can any of you think of how that maybe felt? You know, being the youngest kid and the older one, they don't get in trouble. They get away with stuff. I see some fingers being pointed. It's true. What did he have to overcome? What aspects of his human carnal nature did he have to get over so that he could accept that that big brother of his was actually the Son of God, was actually the Messiah? The one that he probably kicked at when he didn't want to do what his brother told him to do. And he writes this. James 4 and verse 1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Now this isn't just wars and fights in countries, but from us. From families. From churches, from countries. We're all together, right? You and me, us. We're a family. And he says, but where do those wars and fights come from? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? It's, I want what I want. I don't want what you want. And you can't tell me what's good for me. I don't care if everybody votes to do the same thing. I'm going to do what I want to do. You can go jump in a lake. That's how we are. It's our desires. Verse 2, you lust and do not have. It's that desire to have something. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. All these things that we think, if I can just have my way, then somehow that's going to make me happy, that I'm going to have joy in my life. If I can just have that thing, or maybe I can have what you have. Maybe I can take that. Because that's human nature. And the fact is even though we've been called into God's church, we have repented and been baptized and have His Holy Spirit living in us, we are still at war with our human nature. He says, you fight in war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. So often the things that we're asking for, that we're saying, well, I'll be happy when I can have that. This will make me feel real or useful or loved or proud. And God says, that's not good for you. Ask me and I'll give you what will fill you up, what will satisfy you, what will heal you. And we go, that's not what I want. I want that. And I want you to give it to me. Well, what loving parent is going to give their child something that will lead to their death? He says, you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures, on what your desires are, on what you want. Not what he says. It says, adulterers and adulteresses, those who are unfaithful. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have friends. It doesn't mean that we aren't a part of our families, our friendships, our community. But to be friends with the world is to be filled with the pride of life, with the lust of the flesh, the pride of the eyes. Well, that looks pretty good to me, you know. Who wouldn't want to be famous? Who wouldn't want to be rich? Who wouldn't want all this stuff? And boy, those parties look like a lot of fun. Doesn't look like they're getting in trouble. Why do I have to be the good one? Whoever wants to be friend with the world makes himself an enemy of God. Because that's not God's way. And what is not God's way is bad for you. It's bad for us. It's bad because we can look out and see what's happening. Human nature that we all still have is what we have to be at war with. When I was in high school, there was a book that we had to read. It was written in 1954, and it was a work of fiction, but it came out, and it had such a huge impact that it became required reading in most schools. How many of you had to read or remember the book, The Lord of the Flies? Yeah, a few. It's interesting because I hadn't thought about the book in decades. And Sarah was talking with one of her friends who was telling her about this really bizarre book that she had to read. It was called The Lord of the Flies, about these boys and how all this stuff happens. And it just didn't make any sense to her. And I remember saying, well, that's because you don't understand what it means. Again, it was written in 1954. And many say that it's truly just a treatise on the evils of human nature and government and laws and rules. But the man who wrote it was a Christian. But he was also a rationalist. He believed in rational thought. And he would try to put these things together. I'll give you a brief synopsis. The book begins with an airplane, and it's full of English schoolboys between the ages of 6 and 12 years old, and they're being evacuated. There's a war going on during that time. A lot of the fears in our nation, in our world, were atomic. The bomb had been dropped. That was what ended World War II. And all across our land, we would have fallout shelters being built. There were drills that the children had to go through that if it was a bomb, okay, kids, get underneath your desks or out in the hall and tuck and cover. Some of you actually lived in that time. You experienced some of those things. And that was the height of the anxiety. It wasn't COVID-19 or anything like that. It was nuclear war that had just been discovered, and it was terrifying because all it took was one madman. So that's where the book is set. And there's a war going on, and it doesn't go into detail about it, but these kids are on an airplane, and something happens, and they're shot down, and they crash into an island, a jungle island. And the adults that were on the plane, their teachers, their caregivers, the pilots, they all die. And they're scattered around, and then one boy finds a seashell, a conch, and he blows on it. And out of the jungle comes all these boys, these children, leaderless, with not an adult in sight. And so they come together and they decide, we've got to figure out a way to survive. We need someone to lead us. We're scared. And so there's two boys that are kind of the natural leaders. They're both intelligent. They're both strong. But they all select the boy who blew the conch, the first one. They look at him and they're like, we trust you. Now, the boy who wasn't selected, he goes away hurt because he'd been rejected. They hadn't chosen him. And now you have this harm, this flaw that begins to go deep. And it's one of the things which eventually begins to infect all of them. As time goes by, they figure out that, man, they kind of hit the jackpot on where they crashed. Everything they need is right there. They've got fantastic water. They've got a jungle around them with everything they need to build structures, to help them to survive, huts and that sort of thing. And then there's animals that they can hunt. There's apparently wild pigs running around on this island. And they're like, we can sharpen spears and we can go kill them. We can get meat. And so they begin to try to come together as this society because everything they need has been provided. And they begin to try to build these structures, and the older boys are trying to help, but the younger kids want to go off and play. They really don't want to work. And then one by one, the older ones are like, boy, that looks like a lot more fun. I just want to do what I want to do. And I know this guy's trying to tell me that this is for our good, but boy, that water looks inviting. And they're having fun, and I'm over here working. And so they slowly depart, and the tension grows. Eventually, another aspect is brought in because they're They're talking with the boys, and the symbol of authority or governance or rules is whoever holds the conch. They get to speak. And the conch finally gets passed to one of the littlest boys. And he expresses a fear. He says, well, what about the beast? You ever been scared of the dark when you were little? It's like ingrained in you. And this little boy expresses that fear. And the oldest boys are like, there's no beast. You don't have to worry about it. There's no beast on this island. And yet, that seed of fear has been planted. And now they begin to whisper about it, especially the little ones. It kind of grows. Beast? Scary? Monster? What's that? Is it going to get us? And the youngest one says, well, I think it comes from the sea. Some of you are picking up on some of the religious aspects of this, how things are shown. And so this fear begins to grow. Now, the young boy who was not selected to be the leader, he decides and they choose him to be the hunter. They give him a job because he's pretty brave, he's pretty athletic, and he's going to hunt. And he gets his group together that they're going to follow him. And they become successful. And throughout all of this, they're becoming just a little more savage day in and day out. Because there's no one to tell them, no, don't do this. And they revert back. And the boy who's the hunter at one point takes mud and stuff and he paints his face. He creates a mask to help him hunt the pigs. And in doing so, he feels liberated. He's freed of the restrictions of society, of who he had once been, because now he has this new face, this covering. He's hidden. You see the same thing happening in our cities today. The savagery. The one boy who's the leader tries to talk to them and say, this isn't good. You're getting wild. You're getting crazy. But this also the idea of this beast becomes more and more powerful. They finally kill one of the pigs, and they take its head and they put it on a stick. And they put it in the jungle as an offering to appease the beast that's out there. There's one young boy who, as they're discussing things, he begins to realize, he's like, there's no beast. There's no beast out there. The problem is the beast in here. There's a beast in each and every one of us that's terrible and is fearful, and it's taking control, and this is what we have to be afraid of. And he goes into the jungle to try and prove it to them. And it's interesting because he finally finds this stick with the pig's head on it, and he has an epileptic seizure. And in that seizure, he has a dream or a vision, and the head of this pig begins to talk to him. And it says, I am the Lord of the flies, this corrupted skull, this head. The Lord of the flies is an alliteration to the gods, or the demons of Canaan, of the Philistines, Baalzebub. Is the name for the Lord of the flies. This boy eventually figures out that there's no beast, that what they saw is not what they thought it was, and he tries to go back and tell them that they're okay, that they're safe, that there's nothing wrong, but they have become so savage and so enraged, and they're dancing around the fire with their spears, hunt the beast, kill the beast, spill its blood, that when the boy comes out to tell them that they're fine, they murder him. They kill him. And it just degrades from there, worse and worse. They're fighting against each other until they decide they don't even want the two boys who've been trying to guide them and teach them and help them to tell them anything anymore. They're throwing all those shackles off. They kill one with a rock, and then they decide to kill the one that they first elected to be their leader. And they say, we're going to get him like we get the pigs. We're going to start a fire, and we're going to drive him into the open. And in their fervor, in their screaming and yelling and chanting, they catch the entirety of their little world, their island, on fire. And the boy is running through the jungle, what's left of it. And as it's burning down, he stumbles onto the beach where he's got no more protection. And all the boys are coming, and their world is in shambles. It is roaring and flaming. And then on the beach is a man. And it's this shock. There's a man. He's a naval officer. He's a soldier. He's in a uniform. And he's a symbol of law and order. And he came because he saw the devastation. From so far away, he saw the smoke billowing up. And they went to see what was going on. And the boys look and they're like, well, we were crashed and it was an island. And they try to explain how it was that they survived. And in this pristine, beautiful place to the moment that it all burned up, that it was all destroyed, and they were about to kill the one that they'd selected to be their leader. And they couldn't explain it. They couldn't rationalize it. And then they just fell down at this man's feet and began to weep and cry. They recognized him as a symbol of authority and also their salvation. And they couldn't explain why they had done what they had done. But they wept in grief and joy at being saved. Brethren, this world has been given its head, has been allowed to choose its own way for thousands of years. Not God's way, but our way. We're going to throw off the shackles of God's law, His rules, His government. And we're going to run wild. And in the end, brethren, this world that was created for us, that was perfect, that God looked at and said, it is good. Everything they have is available. We ourselves will burn it down. And it is only then that Christ can save us. That when His feet land on the Mount of Olives, that those who are left will turn and weep. Because we did it to ourselves. We had our own way, and look what we did. And that law, that government, will save us. Isaiah 9 and verse 2. This is a prophecy of the Messiah, the one who will come, who will save the world, and the freedom that He will give. Isaiah 9 and verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. They were in that jungle, in that wilderness, but they've seen the light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you, according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you have broken the yoke of their burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. But that rod, that yoke, that staff, that was of their own doing. It's what they did to themselves. It's those laws, those governments that man built up and said, we will govern ourselves. That's where the corruption comes from. In verse 5, for every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of fire. All that is left of mankind, the violence, all that's going to be what burns. For unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. And the government will be upon his shoulder. It's not going to be lawless. It's not going to be anarchy. It will be salvation. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. That peace that people think that they're fighting for right now and vandalizing and looting and killing for, this is what is going to come. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. God's laws, God's rules, his government. Brethren, just like that story, mankind has to learn that freedom, true freedom, comes not from the absence of law. It's not socialism. It's not democracy or any other form of man's government, but a theocracy, a government of God that mankind has never wanted, even when it was offered. But that is the only government that will bring true liberty, true freedom. We look at James again. James in chapter 1. This is what James writes, and he's speaking to us. He's speaking to you and I as disciples, as followers of Christ, as the one who is coming. He says, so then, in verse 19, James 1, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Is anybody doing that anymore? You know, we see something we don't like. Somebody writes something, somebody says something, and what do? Bang! How dare you? I am offended. And we attack. In fact, it seems like the faster we attack, the more people respect it. Wow, you're quick. But that's not what was been given to us. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. You think you're angry? You think you're offended? Guess what? You are not righteous. You're not. I'm not either. There is one righteous. There is one who is good. And that one is God. It is virtually impossible for us to have righteous anger because it's still about me. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls, our lives, both now and in eternity. This is a sense of humility that it's not about me. It's not where someone says, I've had it and I'm not going to take it anymore. It's unrighteous. That's not our place. It never has been. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. You know, we can sit in here and say, well, I've read the Bible my whole life. I keep the Sabbath my whole life. But what are we doing? That is what makes us His. That is what we have to do. We can't get caught up in all this other stuff because none of it is righteous. I'm pro this. I'm anti that. Guess what? None of it is of God. None of it is righteous. Some of it might have more good than the other. But do you think there's going to be a Republican or a Democrat in God's kingdom? Nope. Sorry. We won't have those labels. You will either be God's or we won't be there. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself and goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. Who is it that you used to be? Who is it that we've been called out of to be a new creation? No longer Dave, no longer myself, but of God, of Christ. I don't get to react the way that I used to. And yet, it's still there, isn't it? That old man. How many of you heard something this week and became indignant? How many of you watched something and it made you mad? I did. Yeah. And I was like, ugh! How dare they? You know what? They need this. I've got the idea of how to fix them. This'll teach them. Guess what? Not righteous. Absolutely not righteous. Carnal. Me. Natural enemy of God. And it's still there. And we have to be on guard against it, brethren, all the time, because you're being inundated with it. And we want to pick a side. But there's no right side. None of it's right. None of it is of God. This is Satan's world. He's the one fanning the flames. But how easy is it to want to pick a side and then hate the person on the other one? If anyone among you thinks he is religious, I'm a good person. I go to church. I keep God's laws, His Sabbaths. I pay my tithes. But does not bridle his tongue? Oops. Has there been a moment where you've been like, oh, I can't believe I said that? Or maybe you went, well, I don't care. It needed to be said. If we do not bridle our own tongue, but deceives our own heart into thinking, well, it needed to be said. I'm going to tell them what's what. That one's religion is useless. Doesn't mean anything. We look out and we judge and we project ourselves. Well, I know what right and wrong is, and I'm going to tell you. I can tell you what's wrong with you. I can tell you what's wrong with our government. You can walk into any coffee shop around the world and everybody's talking about it. And we've all got the fix, right? Except you're not righteous. It's not the fix. We can look at each other and do the same thing. We can look at other families and go, well, did you see that family? Do you see their kids? I know how to fix that. Back in my day. Except, you know what? Not righteous. We're not doing any good. We can do that in the church of God. We can look at somebody else and go, well, I think they're doing it wrong. We can say that to the church. You're wrong. And I'm going to tell you, except you are not righteous. None of us. That kind of, somebody points at us. I got a bunch of them pointing back. None of us are righteous, perfect, infallible. And yet human nature sure wants to think that we are. The way that we become righteous is to do good. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this. We know that the love of God is to keep His commandments and that they're not a burden. So we do obey. But to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble. This isn't just someone who's widowed. This isn't just someone who doesn't have a father. It's those who are hurting, who are grieving, who are struggling. Maybe it's financially, but more often than not, it's brokenhearted. What we've suffered because of the world, the sin that is in it. We're desperate for that Savior, for a true Father. This week I saw in the midst of one of the riots, I don't know where it was, but there was a young black man, a boy. He might have been 15 or 16 years old. He was tall and just skinny. And they were rioting all around him, and there was a black man talking to him. And he was passionate. And he looked by his T-shirt. He might have been a veteran. I don't know. But he was telling this kid, he said, don't do this. He said, be better than us. We made these mistakes. We lashed out. We destroyed. We broke things. Be better than us. Don't do this. And that boy, his lip was trembling, his chin. And he looked like he just wanted that man to hug him. I don't know if that boy had ever been talked to by a father figure like that. But just like those boys in that story who fell at the foot of that officer on the beach, they're desperate for it. That is what will heal. That is what will fill us up. That's who we need to be looking for. Those who are truly in need. Those who are without a true father. Those who have never known a true husband. And we keep oneself unspotted from the world. That wrath and anger, that's going to get on us. The white robes that we're supposed to have cannot be dark with anger and hatred. People say that they don't want law, that they don't want authority. I've even heard that amongst believers. They'll look at me or someone in the church, an administration, and go, I'll have no authority over me. No one can tell me anything but God Himself. You might as well be wearing a black T-shirt and throwing rocks. It makes as much sense. Because that's not God's way. It never has been. There is authority. We're supposed to be learning it now. There is God's law. We're supposed to be living that now. That we may rejoice. See, when mankind says they don't want rules, they don't want laws, they want to be free, what that actually means is, I want to be free of the consequences. I want to be free to do whatever I want and then not have to pay the price. I want to behave however I want. And hey, would you make a pill for that? How about a vaccine? How about you just let me go? Let me out of prison. Because I want to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm not going to change. God's law is truly about freedom. Freedom from those consequences, because we won't be doing the actions. When the children of Israel received the law, when Moses brought that to them and they heard it, and they took those vows, they said, "What you have said we will do, and in doing it we will understand. And we will live and we will prosper." And Moses said, "Choose. I set before you blessings and cursings, life and death. Choose life." God's law is blessings and life. Or choose to go your own way, and you'll be cursed. Because you'll do it to yourself. And you'll die because you did it to yourself. But that is the lesson that all of mankind has to learn. We've been given a chance to learn it now. To do it better, just like that man told that boy. Do it better. Freedom comes, brethren, from doing it better. From recognizing what true freedom is, which is the law of life. God's law. And that's what everyone out there is looking for. Can you show it to them? Can you be that light and that example? That's what we've been called to do. First fruits. We've got our work cut out for us, brethren. But each and every one of you has it within you to be that light, to be an example of what true freedom is. Embrace it.